Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short sci-fi and fantasy stories.
It is often said that in our final moments, we see our life flash before our eyes. Time becomes subjective, your life history flashing by in a few seconds, or memories roll by in great detail. There is debate about whether this experience is real or just a hallucination. Some have argued this is an adrenaline effect, while others believe it is the transition to the beyond, a point at which one is forced to reflect on their life. But there is no way to know. In this month's story, an astronaut, the sole survivor of an accident, drifts in space as the air in her environment suit runs out. In a semi-lucid state, she recalls memories, stories she's been told, and relives moments in her life peppered with premonition. We invite you now to sit back and relax as you listen to Makeshift Stories 97, Five Moments. Somewhere in some time, we'll all face the last moment. She drifted in the void, dreaming, hallucinating, remembering, waiting for the inevitable. 1. The silver plane was almost motionless in the heavy summer sky. It hung on the throbbing sound of its two piston engines, struggling to pull it through the hot, syrupy air, pinned nose first to the only cloud in the sky, a stubborn cumulus obstruction in a sea of deep blue. The pudgy plane slowly pushed the cloud along like a tugboat wrangling a large ship. The low growl of the ancient craft sunk to the ground, filling the backyard with its distant struggle as Ellis, oblivious to its presence, burst out onto the sun-soaked sidewalk, the porch door straining against its rusty springs, hooked by bent nails to the doorframe. Once released, the door slammed, rattling its single-paned window, and Alice, barefooted, ran out onto the hot concrete sidewalk, arms extended, luxuriating in the heat beating down on her head and radiating up from below. It was the first day of summer holidays. Free. She was free to do whatever she wanted. Alice spun around on the sidewalk, then stepped onto the grass, carefully avoiding the prickly thistles that her father had carefully mowed down to blend into the patchy lawn. She ducked onto the sheets hanging limply on the clothesline, bleaching in the sun, and once out from under their shadow, threw herself down on a weedless patch of grass and rolled over to look at the sky. The labored drone of the plane, now only halfway from horizon to horizon, finally caught her attention. Alice reached out with one arm, sighted down it, framing the tiny toy-like aluminum craft and the cloud it was pushing between her thumb and index finger. Then slowly, ever so slowly, she brought her fingers together, shoving the plane into the cloud. Fascinated, she paused and stared at the captured conglomerate for a moment, before she closed her fingers a bit more, making the cloud suddenly pop like a balloon, making both it and the plane disappear. Alice laughed, happy with her first feat of magic for the summer, then drew in a breath containing an unfortunate fly and began to gag, choking on the insect as it lodged in her windpipe. She frantically gasped for air, rolling onto her knees, turning blue in the process before dislodging the now dead bug and spitting it out onto the ground. Alice fell back onto the grass, her oxygen-starved lungs desperately sucking in air as a small red light flashed somewhere in the extreme periphery of her vision, flashed somewhere beyond the edge of the summer day. 2. The TV listing scrolled up the large screen in slow motion. 150 channels of nothing, interspersed with repeats, stale-dated news, and reality TV shows about everything that Alice had no interest in. After channel hopping in hopes of creating a montage that would at least hold her attention for a few moments, Alice gave up after hitting the same ad on three different stations. She eventually turned the TV off, then looked out through the sliding glass door which led out onto a small balcony and beyond into the blizzard which had obscured the winter night. The orange glow of sodium vapor street lamps outlined the ghosts of a spider web of roads, spreading out and disappearing into the throat of the storm. One street, with a particularly dense trail of red taillights smudged by the snow and car exhaust, caught her attention. It reminded her of a photo she had seen once of a rift valley taken from orbit. Alice got up and walked over to the glass doors, shivering at the thought of being outside in one of those cars. She tried to imagine what it would be like down there, 36 stories below, the wind cutting through even the densest coat. The thought made her shiver again, causing her to back away from the doors into the warmth of the room. Despite the raging storm outside, the hotel suite was hot. Too hot, in fact. It was as if the heating system was overcompensating for the world outside. Almost sweating, Alice sat down in a fake leather chair next to the too narrow and too high desk that was part of the cabinet to which the pointless TV was fixed. Optimistically, she opened a browser on her laptop, only to encounter the endless loop of a spinning progress icon. The internet, jammed with hotel guests informing their friends that they'd be late, that the storm had closed the airport, wasn't accepting any more sessions. Typical, Alice thought. Bad weather seemed to follow her like an adoring puppy, trailing her, optimistically looking for the right moment to jump up and get in her face. And tonight in particular, when she had no choice but to be flying to her destiny, her old familiar had emerged from its hiding place and whipped up a roadblock. Frustrated, Alice got up and paced the room, then walked over to the sliding glass doors and looked out again. The orange streetlights had become indistinct ghosts in the growing storm. She turned the room lights off to make it easier to see out. Despite the wind and dropping temperatures outside, she knew that the place she was going was infinitely more dangerous, so the cocoon created by the blizzard was oddly comforting. It reduced visibility to only a few meters, making the most distant object in its universe something you could reach out and touch. It was the opposite of infinite, and it was the infinite that made Alice unsure, made her fear its unknowability. She pushed the thought aside and peered out into the night, straining her eyes until she could see something through the static of the blizzard. She turned her head and looked back into the now darkened suite to reset her eyes, then turned back to stare. It was still there. A ghostly shape. A shape she knew, or would know. She couldn't tell which. Possibly some type of craft, magically suspended in the air. Alice watched the chaotic snowflakes, backlit by a light on the adjacent building, devour the phantom, then suddenly felt separated from the rest of the world by an insurmountable distance. She turned away, distracted by an urgent beeping somewhere behind her, warning her. Warning her of what? For some reason, her mind couldn't quite grasp why she should be concerned. She surveyed the darkened suite, but there was nothing in the room making the sound. Alice turned back to the sliding glass doors. Outside, the storm had somehow intensified again, and a blast of wind sent a hurricane of snow pounding against the glass, trying to get in, trying to get at her, which made her involuntarily step back. The snow calmed for a moment, revealing the indistinct shape of the mysterious craft again. She squinted, trying to make out what it was. Then her heart jumped in recognition. However, before she could confirm what she had just seen, there was a sudden spasmodic flash which disturbed the illusion. Maybe it had been the high beam of a car lost in the storm, or more likely, she tried to rationalize, a spotlight on the adjacent building had been blown loose in the wind and swung around for an instant in her direction. But no, she thought, it was more like an explosion, ripping the familiar shape into thousands of flakes, which merged into the noise of the storm, disappearing into its violence. On an impulse, she slid the door open and peered out into the blizzard to confirm what she had just witnessed. A sudden gust caused the soggy snowflakes to rush at her in a horizontal rage, causing Alice to instinctively gasp, taking in a lungful of the thick, muddy air. She choked, unable to breathe, and fell back into the room. 3. The road raced by through the small dime-sized hole in the floor of the back seat. A hole. Why would there be a hole in the car's floor? It seemed unsafe. What authority would even allow a car like that on the road? Alice thought. However, the hole was a detail her grandmother had stubbornly insisted on every time she had retold the story. Think of when it took place, Alice reminded herself. It was a different era, with a much different sense of what was dangerous. Her grandmother, fascinated by the hole, preferred to look through it rather than the car window. At least that is what she had claimed. Through the hole, with the ground racing past, she imagined that they were flying over some vast landscape at an incredible speed, racing away from the city faster than sound. The car hit a bump in the road, knocking a well-thumbed pamphlet onto the floor, covering the hole. Alice Sr., Alice and her grandmother shared the same name, reached down and picked it up, turning the pamphlet over. She liked the cover, which consisted of a loosely drawn white cartoon car on a red background that was sprinting along a thick black arrow which led away from the skyline of a distant city, ringed in a white bullseye. Spelt out in heavy block letters were the words, "Four Wheels to Survival." And that's what Ellis understood they were doing, fleeing the threatened city for the family cottage to wait out the crisis. It was October 1962, and her father, in a fit of concern, had taken the unusual preemptive step of removing Alice and her sister from school, arranging holidays at work, packing up their 15-year-old car, and heading out to the summer cottage they had closed up for the winter in September. Alice dropped the pamphlet back on the seat beside her, then bored, pulled herself up to look out the car window. Spruce trees, mixed with outcroppings of rock and skeletal aspens that were in the process of dropping their last leaves, flowed by. The car radio crackled with the voices of tense announcers commenting, speculating, and cross-examining each other. They made the distant crisis seem so close, as if it was just happening over the horizon in the wheat fields, so close that from a tall building one might be able to see the Soviet supply ships stubbornly approaching and threatening to cross the American blockade so they could deliver their deadly cargo to Havana. It didn't appear that either side was going to back down. So now Alice's father was wheeling them away to a safe haven, wheeling them away to survival. He had been obsessed with the unfolding events and hadn't slept in weeks, pacing the house in the dark at night, until October 23rd, when he had insisted they all leave the city. Located downwind from the Minuteman silos, dug into the subtle prairie landscape only 120 miles away, if not a target, he claimed, then at minimum the city would be snowed under in fallout from the Soviet ICBMs. "They call it a deterrent," he would laugh. "They call it a safety net. But really, those missiles make it more dangerous. The government might just as well have painted a bullseye on our city and on us." Those missiles would be among the first targets, he rationalized, and once hit, a flood of people would be jamming the roads to escape the death carried on the prevailing winds. However, they were going to avoid all that. They would already be safe in their bolt hole, their cottage, far to the east, well out of the fallout shadow. After 2 more hours, the old Plymouth turned and rolled onto the deserted gravel road that led around the lake. Now too far from the city, the radio finally lost the station, amplified static replacing the news. They wound their way along the narrow twisting road, until they found the old car tracks veering off to the left that served as a driveway, turned off, bouncing along the ruts until they came to the clearing where their modest cottage stood. Alice woke the next morning, cocooned in heavy blankets. Her nose, the only exposed part of her body, was freezing, and she could see her breath. In the next room she could hear her father shoving wood into the ancient stove that served as the only heat source. In the summer, the stove made the whole cottage intolerably hot when they cooked, but now it could barely keep the kitchen warm. Alice dressed onto the blankets, then slipped out of bed.
"Did you sleep well?"
her father questioned, looking like he'd been up all night yet again.
"Is your sister still in bed?"
Alice nodded.
"Okay, your mother's out getting water from the lake. We'll have breakfast ready soon, then I'll need your help putting up the antenna."
The antenna was for the large antique radio powered by vacuum tubes that sat on the table next to the couch. With the antenna, using the shortwave band, the big dials could tune in signals thousands of miles away, which was probably why her father had kept the old thing, Alice thought, just for a situation like this. However, a windstorm at the end of the season had blown the antenna down, rendering the radio useless.
"We need to know, Alice,"
her father started to say, then thought better of it, and went back to stoking the stove's firebox. After breakfast, Alice struggled up the ladder onto the roof. The fear of heights was something that the young girl had inherited from her mother, and that fear had been passed down, mother to daughter, to the present. So Alice knew how hard it would have been for her grandmother to climb up onto the roof of that cottage. But she knew she had no choice. Her grandmother had to help her father find out, had to help him face his fears. Alice's grandmother, at this point in the story, had always focused on the vertigo. She said her fear was overwhelming and it made her head spin, but she pushed her fear away and gingerly stepped off the ladder, clinging to the shingles, and crawled carefully to the peak, where she grabbed the base of a wooden pole that would hold up the wire. While her father began to strap the pole to the chimney, Alice looked west over the trees, careful not to look down. It was a deep blue cloudless, late fall sky. The bare branches of nearby poplar trees knifed into the cold air, silently waiting for winter. Without warning, both were suddenly washed out by a silent flash, so brilliant that Alice was forced to look away to protect her eyes. She saw the rocky ground, which now oddly looked hundreds of miles away, rush up toward her. She instinctively swiveled around and tried to grab a metal anchor screwed into the roof, and missed. The desperate action caused her to spin around again, so she faced the ground, which now appeared to be flying away from her faster than she was falling. Then her grandmother was gone. Now it was Alice falling. The blocky silhouette of the cottage rolled into view between her and the brown and red desolate surface of another world. However, the cottage looked odd. Some unforeseen force appeared to have peeled parts of one side away, and what was left bristled with fronds of antennae, and there were two lights at its extremities, blinking lights, like an airplane flying through the night, buoyed up by the darkness. Before she could orient herself to this new reality, the cottage below her, now falling with her, became a momentary sun. A red light began to flash in the corner of her vision. It went from red to orange, and then green, as a hissing sound she hadn't noticed before slowed and finally stopped. The air around her seemed somehow thinner, and her mind clouded. Another light began to flash. It was a warning. Something about the air. Alice didn't understand why she knew that. Then a strong arm reached out from nowhere and grabbed her, halting her tumble.
"Alice, you almost slid off the roof."
"But the flash," she questioned anxiously.
"I know. It's got to be the Soviets. They must have run the blockade."
4. The day was too hot to be dressed for a wedding. The midsummer sun beat down on the formal attire of the guests who were waiting for their pictures to be taken. The youngest in the wedding party, whose sole role was to fill in the gaps for the large family portraits, were huddled around a portable transistor 8 radio that the bride's brother had brought along. The anemic device was barely strong enough to pick up a signal in the lakeside park, located 30 miles northeast of the city. The three kids huddled close, straining to hear, while the adults, oblivious to the importance of the moment, went about the ritual of the wedding portraits.
"How could anyone have been so stupid?" Alice wondered.
But maybe, she rationalized, her adult ancestors had been gambling against a chancy endeavor ever succeeding, and had simply lost, paying their debt by not being able to witness the event of the millennium. In another reality, she thought, they would have won, and the mission fail. Alice had heard her grandmother's story so many times that she had invented her own memory of how the park looked on that late July day in 1969, how the sun was absorbed by the material of the bridesmaids' dark purple dresses and the black suits of the best men, making everyone sweat. She pictured them as dark, absorbent spots on the white sand of the beach, in contrast to her own small, bright speck in the frozen dark. Alice let her mind drop back into the story, imagining the authoritative voice of the announcer struggling to surge through the static. The boy who had brought the radio grabbed it and swung it around in a vain attempt to improve the reception. He quickly gave up and put it back onto the picnic table, increasing the volume instead, which didn't help. But to Alice's way of thinking, the random crackling seemed to be the right accompaniment for such an event. After all, it was the universe's serenade, the background noise of the Big Bang. Her grandmother didn't know that, so in her telling of the story, it was just interference, like the wedding itself, something that made witnessing history all the harder.
They have 10% fuel remaining, which gives them 65 seconds of flight time to land the LEM.
The silky baritone of the commentator announced, a nervous edge creeping into his voice.
And that will be cutting it tight. We'll now return to the live voice of Mission Control for the final moments.
23 meters. We're looking good. Down a half. Forward 6. There's a small crater. 60 seconds. Down 1.5. Forward. Forward. Great. 12 meters. Down 1.2. Kicking up dust. 9 meters. 1.2 down. I see our shadow now.
There was a static-filled pause, increasing the tension. The three young listeners leaned in closer, fingers crossed.
30 seconds. Drift forward. Yes. Okay. Contact light. Okay. Engine stop.
The sudden collective suspense became a cheer. A cheer that Alice's grandmother had claimed circled the entire globe, except for a small spot in that park. One of the children waved excitedly at the wedding party, whom, caught up in its own moment, had simply ignored the noise over at the picnic table as the first human planted a foot on the stark surface of the moon. The ash-gray image of the historical instant faded into ochre and rust, and the desolate black sky of the harsh lunar landscape lightened to rose. The paper-thin limb hardened to a squat stubby-winged shuttle, and everything else shifted to a more recent past. The first steps were now on red regolith instead of gray. Alice looked out from an open hatch. She was the third one through, the third set of footprints on the pristine surface. And she knew that somewhere, someone had most likely bet against this moment ever happening. A sudden wind picked up the fine regolith, making a dust devil that traveled away from the small group. It was all so hauntingly familiar. Made dreamlike through the visor of her pressure suit. Alice imagined herself unlocking her helmet, taking the first breath on a new world, taking in its smell, taking its essence into her lungs. Her hands instinctively moved up to the latches that held her visor in place. Then a warning light urgently flashed, and static surged through her radio. Her lungs strained to suck in the imaginary air. Another gust of wind chased the superfine dust around her feet into a cloud, turning the landscape into a shapeless, dark, ochre field of static. 5. Brilliant starlight streamed through Alice's visor, crisp tiny points of warmth in the ultra-cold nothingness. Separated from the immensity of the universe by the thin walls of her environment suit, Alice slowly tumbled, like a small asteroid on its meandering journey across the cosmos. Outside, infinite silence. Inside, the irregular beat of actuators straining to capture the last atoms of oxygen from her damaged tanks. Fear momentarily took over, making her body panic, her lungs heave uncontrollably, and her mind race. Her future was now defined by a limited number of breaths and heartbeats, except, Alice rationalized, that had always been true since the day she was born. There would only be so many breaths. So many heartbeats in a single life. However, even an hour ago, that number seemed too large to be of concern. Now, with only a few hundred or a few dozen left, despite what her senses were insisting, she knew she had already died. The point between now and then simply representing the mechanics of the process. Eyes, ears, heart had not yet figured out just how close the inevitable was. Alice's oxygen-starved mind cleared for a moment, recent memories flooding back. She had stood on the surface, one of only three to disturb the ancient Martian regolith. That wasn't a dream. And they had returned safely to orbit. That had happened. And she'd been outside in the pressure suit, doing routine maintenance on the high-gain antenna, when there had been an impact on the ship.
Maybe it was a silver dollar-sized micrometeor, or a piece of ice, traveling at 10 or 12 kilometers per second, fast enough to give them no warning before delivering enough kinetic energy to become a small bomb, which ripped the fragile craft open and dislodged the antenna and Alice, launching both on their cosmic journeys. Okay, she'd initially thought, a problem, but not an insurmountable one. However, that was before a short-lived star was born behind her as a fuel tank erupted, sending a blizzard of metal shards chasing after her. A bang, followed by the hiss of escaping air, confirmed her destiny as the impact spun her around to face the stars, adding a bit more velocity to her journey into the infinite. The light. She tried to concentrate on the thousands of pinpoints of light in front of her, pure and welcoming. Images and scenes flashed through her dying mind, blurred, then fled. Alice finally gave in to her destiny, accepting the inevitable. In her helmet radio, the background hiss of the universe beckoned.
I look forward to this new adventure.
She gasped in reply, and held out a gloved hand, framing two of the brightest stars between her thumb and index finger, then slowly closed them, pushing the stars together. It was her last act of magic. In memory of Lois, February 28, 1930 to November 17, 2015.
Thanks for listening to Makeshift Stories 97, 5 Moments. We hope that you've enjoyed this month's episode. As always, if you like what we're doing, please tell your friends about us, or write a review on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, or check us out on Facebook. We love hearing your comments, so send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com, or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. And many thanks to those who have already emailed us from all over the world. We release a new story every month, between the 15th and the 20th. To listen to Makeshift Stories on your iOS or Android device, please download Stitcher Radio from iTunes or the Google Play Store. This month's story was written and read by Alan V. Hare. The opening and closing theme was composed and recorded by David H. Radio static effects, Alien X, and copy C4T from freesound.org. Licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3 license. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution No Derivative license, which means that you're free to share our stories, just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.